morning. Right. The first case of the day is 07-1219, and it is Santiago versus Walls. Mr. Eikensier? Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Nick Eikensier, appearing pro bono for Fabian Santiago. Your Honors, the District Court committed two reversible errors in this case. The first was improperly dismissing three claims early on for failure to state a claim. And the second error was abusing its discretion and refusing to appoint counsel during the pretrial phase. And by way of background, Your Honors, this is an appeal from a final judgment in a 1983 case that Mr. Santiago brought in 2002. Mr. Santiago was and still is an inmate in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections. And that suit alleged, among other things, that the defendants failed to protect Mr. Santiago from two inmate attacks, and that in the wake of those attacks, the defendants used excessive force and failed to provide medical attention.
Now, count one alleges that Rednauer and Butler witnessed Harris making threats against Santiago and refused to report those threats. Who bears the burden of reporting Harris's threats? Were Rednauer and Butler in a position, do you think, to protect Santiago from Harris, or did Santiago have, let's say, an obligation to report the threats to a higher authority?
Well, I'll answer the question in two ways, Your Honor. The first was that the officers who overheard the threats, certainly at the pleading stage, can be assumed to have an obligation to report those. In fact, Mr. Santiago alleges that had the officers reported what were essentially gang-related death threats, according to the allegations, that Mr. Harris or inmate Harris would have been somehow placed on Mr. Santiago's what's called an enemy list, and therefore the two inmates would not allowed to have contact with each other. The second is relating to your question about Mr. Santiago's obligation to report these threats. Mr. Santiago didn't know inmate Harris's name at the time. He only knew him by ICE. And it's unclear if he was able to file any kind of grievance on the basis of an inmate's nickname.
Well, were there many ICEs running around the prison?
Your Honor, the record is unclear, and I think certainly it has to be assumed at the pleading stage that Mr. Santiago either was unable to file any sort of grievance just on the basis of this guy's nickname, or that even if he did, prison officials wouldn't know who ICE was, and any attempts by the prison officials to ascertain his identity might have actually carried unintended consequences for Mr. Santiago, insofar as if word gets out that Mr. Santiago is complaining about inmate Harris, Harris might have even more reason to deliver on his threat. So, Your Honor, jumping right into count one then, the standard for failure to protect, this at least the pleading standard, is whether the defendants were aware of a substantial risk of serious harm to Mr. Santiago and failed to act. And that's precisely what he alleged here. He alleged that the two officers overheard death threats shouted against Mr. Santiago on behalf of a gang member with whom Mr. Santiago was in an altercation with at the time. Now, true, Mr. Santiago alleges that the guard simply did nothing in response, but doing nothing may well be negligence, ultimately, as the defendants point out in their brief. But at the pleading stage, it has to be assumed that the defendants were deliberately indifferent and doing nothing.
After the Supreme Court's opinion in Ashcroft against IQBAL, last week, have the pleading standards changed any?
Your Honor, to be honest, I have not read that the Supreme Court's opinion, so I'm not in a position to comment on whether that changed the pleading standards.
Shall we go to count two?
Sure. Well, is count four better since it's the same cause of action?
Well.
Sorry, I'll move to count two. Count two was an excessive force claim against the inmates. Well, by way of background, I'll back up a little bit. Mr. Santiago alleged that he was sitting down eating lunch in a cafeteria when inmate Harris, the assailant from the last count, approached him from behind and started punching him in the back of the head.
But you see, here's the issue as I view it for count two. Given Santiago's testimony at trial that he was preparing to strike Harris, albeit in self-defense, when the officers, you know, spray him with mace, what would be the point, do you think, of remanding his Eighth Amendment claim in count two? Because how can he demonstrate that the officers sprayed the mace without any legitimate penological justification when he acknowledges himself that they were, you know, they were trying to break up a what looked to be a severe altercation?
A very fair point, Your Honor. I can only say that the allegations themselves are a little bit more complicated than simply he was standing up to strike. He alleges that the defendants in this case, which were two guards who were in the cafeteria, were standing about 5 feet away from Mr. Santiago and saw Harris approach him, start punching him in the back of the head, yet refused to intervene, and allegedly intentionally waited for Mr. Santiago to try to defend himself, at that point coming in and macing Mr. Santiago. But moreover, there's not just the macing incident in count two. There's also the tackling Mr. Santiago to the ground from behind. And if you parse his allegations that he attaches in a grievance to the complaint, he explains that after he was maced, he was completely submissive, and obviously the fight was over. He couldn't see, and then he was nonetheless tackled from behind by the second defendant here. So certainly, assuming the macing was a good faith application of force, there's still no justification at that point for tackling him from behind to the ground. So, Your Honors, the count we haven't discussed yet that was dismissed for failure to state a claim is count four. And just by way of background again, that count alleged that the basis for that count was attack against Mr. Santiago by his cellmate, who at the time was an inmate by the name of Castro. And again, all he needed to allege to state a claim was that the defendants were aware of a substantial risk of serious harm, yet failed to act. And his allegations on that point, again, meet this hurdle. He alleges that both that the warden here, who is the defendant, was aware that Castro had a history of attacking his cellmates. And I think more importantly here, 4 days before the attack happens, he sends an emergency grievance directly to the warden asking that inmate Castro, his cellmate, be placed on his enemies list and that he be moved out of Castro's cell.
Did Santiago have any personal history with Castro, or did he simply know that, you know, Castro went around assaulting other inmates?
Your Honor, the record's unclear as to where Mr. Santiago came up with this information, but still at the pleading stage, it's permissible to allege upon information and belief. And if he heard through whatever source that inmate Castro had a history or a propensity of attacking cellmates, at least at the pleading stage, an allegation of personal knowledge suffices. In fact, that's in Brown, that was exactly the allegation that this court determined stated a claim.
Do you think that once an inmate assaults another inmate, the prison is obligated to house that individual in a single cell indefinitely?
No, Your Honor. We certainly appreciate the practical realities of trying to run a correctional facility. And obviously not every inmate can be in a single cell status. But here again, in this case, Mr. Santiago, who was the victim of a Harris attack, apparently finds himself the victim of attacks repeatedly, has found himself in a cell with his cellmate who allegedly had this history. And, you know, we maintain that that states a claim, or at least sufficiently alleges that the defendant here was aware of the risk.
If Mr. Santiago had had counsel during the pretrial stage, would it have made a difference with respect to the how he might have alleged these counts that were dismissed?
It may well have, Your Honor. We're not, again, this bleeds over into the second error that we're alleging here, which is the appointment of counsel claim. We maintain the error was not appointing counsel during the discovery phase and waiting until the eve of trial. We certainly don't think it was erroneous for the district court to deny appointment of counsel right out of the gate because, frankly, or else that might give a right to every civil litigant to have counsel. But to answer your question, Your Honor, I think it certainly would have streamlined the amended complaint and any kind of motion to dismiss, and arguably probably would have conserved some judicial resources.
Would he have, during discovery, possibly obtained information that would have allowed him to amend the dismissal counts so they would have withstood a motion to dismiss?
I believe so, Your Honor. He certainly sought the identity and location of both the witnesses to some of these things and was stonewalled by the defendants. He tried to obtain camera footage that allegedly captured some of these incidents directly and was able to get it. And I think more importantly, he tried and tried and tried to depose the defendants but just couldn't do it from a cell in a different facility than the one in which he was located because he was moved. Your Honors, I see I'm in my rebuttal time.
I know you are, but I do have one. I just want to follow up because I wondered what evidence we have that the alleged security camera footage of Officer Keyes and Santiago walking to the infirmary exists, or if it did exist, that it was preserved.
Well, Your Honor, there is a document request in the record that Mr. Santiago filed asking for, there's actually two cameras that were at two different locations that allegedly captured this. And the defendants, I believe, did respond to this document request just saying, if we have it, we'll give it to you. But the record's unclear as to what happened from there. And at least that we believe appointed counsel could have at least, whether a 30B6 deposition or by some other means, found out how this stuff was stored, how long it's stored, how to retrieve it, et cetera. And if that's okay, Your Honors, I'll stop there and preserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Ellis.
May it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Carl Elitz for the state defendants. They're all employees of the Menard Correctional Center, Your Honors. Menard is one of the largest prisons in the system. I think it may be the largest with about 3,500 prisoners in its population.
So it's larger than Stateville?
I believe so, Your Honor, by a few dozen, I think, the last I checked. So maybe the largest prison in the Seventh Circuit. I'm not sure, but it's a very large institution. I want to begin by making the disclaimer that this is an unusual procedural posture for me, certainly, and I think for our office, in the sense that we don't have an attorney-client representation, an attorney-client relationship with some of the parties here because they were not served with a summons and they did not request the Attorney General's representation. Mr. Eikensier pointed out some cases where the Seventh Circuit has suggested that it's appropriate for us to make the arguments in support of the trial court's decision to dismiss these individuals, these defendants that were not served. I hope that's an appropriate procedure, and that's the one that's the reason why we briefed the issue. But I want to let the court know that these particular defendants were not served and have not requested the AG's representation. So, but
all
given
all of them,
the ones that are in Warden Walls was represented by the office because there was a count that survived the pleading stage. And so the Attorney General's office did appear and represent Ms. Warden Walls at the trial. But the other defendants that were dismissed out, Redner, Butler, Sumicht, and John Doe, number one, I believe, those defendants didn't make requests because they were never served. So on the merits, with regard to count one, Your Honors, by way of background, it's helpful to consider these incidents, considering the people who were Mr. Santiago claims he was in an altercation with. Mr. Haynes was first, Mr. Harris was second, and Mr. Castro was third. Mr. Haynes and Mr. Santiago had an altercation in April of 2001. He alleges that officers Redner and Butler were there, and they overheard Mr. Harris say to Mr. Santiago, "Don't trip, we'll catch you." And he claims that this was a threat against Mr. Santiago's life and that officers Redner and Butler should have perceived this as a threat and made a report. He claims then that report would have been investigated by his grievance officer and that after that investigation, Mr. Harris, who was known to him as ICE, would have been put on his enemies list. And then after that, being on his enemies list, he would never have been in a situation a year and a month later when Mr. Harris attacked him. It's my suggestion that that chain of events is really too attenuated to allege deliberate indifference, because under the deliberate indifference standard, it's necessary to show that the defendants perceived the risk that ultimately caused the plaintiff injury. And an attack by Mr. Harris 13 months later, after he says to Mr. Santiago, "Don't trip, I'll catch you," certainly shouldn't meet that standard, even under the liberal pleading standards.
Did they report the threat?
They did not report the threat. They reported the incident where Mr. Santiago and Mr. Hayes had a fight. They took Mr. Santiago out of his cell, took him to the infirmary where he spent a few days, and then he was transferred to segregation where he spent 6 months. So there's no reason to believe that in removing him from his cell and making the report about the fight, they would have perceived that at some point Mr. Harris would have injured Mr. Santiago, which is what I suggest is required to allege deliberate indifference. Count one was properly dismissed, Your Honors.
I think maybe you ought to zero in on count four.
Okay. Count four against Warden Walls. The allegation is that the warden should have known that Mr. Castro, Mr. Santiago's cellmate, was a danger to him and should have removed Mr. Santiago from the cell. Recently, and this is a case that was brought to the court's attention by Mr. Eikensier in a Rule 28J letter, the court had an opportunity to talk about warden liability and discussed the warden in that case and suggested that it was improper to bring 1983 action against a warden in a large prison environment because the wardens are not responsible for the day-to-day lives of the prisoners. This case seems to be the same as that case. As I mentioned when I began, Menard is a very large institution. There's no reason to believe that the warden would be responsible for the housing decisions that placed Mr. Santiago in Mr. Castro's cell. It's possible, I suppose, and I think it's a theoretical possibility, and the plaintiff tried to argue that he had filed grievances that would put the warden on notice. But at trial, it came out that the warden was not the one who was processing the emergency grievances, and there are actually responses from the warden's office to grievances that bear out the trial testimony. Warden Walls had an assistant who signed and initialed the grievance responses. That person was not the person who was sued. There is no respondeat superior liability under Section 1983.
You know, I found that argument a bit unsettling. And it's because why would the fact that his emergency grievance was addressed to Warden Wall's office preclude a finding that the warden was aware of the substance of the grievance? In other words, what's unreasonable about assuming that something addressed to his office would reach him? What I worry about is, under your view of the case, nothing would stop a warden from avoiding all liability by delegating inmate complaints addressed to him to a subordinate for handling.
Your Honor, I think it would probably prevent a plaintiff from bringing a 1983 action against a warden who delegated housing responsibility to a housing officer or medical responsibility to a medical officer. That doesn't mean that there is no department employee that could be not liable under Section 1983.
I know, but just imagine totally absolving
By the same token, Your Honor, then the head of the Illinois Department of Corrections could be sued in the same way, and the governor could be sued in the same way.
Not exactly. They're not on site.
That's true. Although, honestly, Your Honor, I don't know that Warden Walls is on site at the same location as the plaintiff in this case. There needs to be, in my view, Your Honor, there needs to be pled a plausible theory as to why the defendant would have personal liability. I know that the pleading requirements under Rule 8 are very liberal. The Supreme Court seems to be pulling those back recently in Twombly and some of the subsequent cases, and I also can't say, that, Judge Ripple, that I've read the decision you refer to, but I think the tenor here is, if I read the Supreme Court correctly...
A hot issue.
It is a hot issue, Your Honor. If I read it correctly, a prisoner particularly, because we also have Section 1915A, which sort of puts a burden on prisoners, Congress intended that complaints or acknowledge that there are a lot of frivolous complaints, and we need to see some culling of complaints by the trial court. If we allow the sort of assumption that everyone in the chain above the prisoner is responsible, then that's just respondeat superior liability, and that's what's been rejected.
But I think the point is that the fact that, you know, the grievance is addressed to the office and signed by one of his one of the warden's subordinates ought not preclude a prisoner's ability to prove that the warden was aware of his complaint and the danger that Castro slash ICE.
I should also say, Your Honor, that the complaint, the grievance that was filed by Mr. Santiago is part of the record. It's attached to my brief. It doesn't tell the warden, even if the warden had read the grievance, that Mr. Castro is the one that Mr. Santiago was concerned about. He said
It says the inmate I'm currently housed with.
Does,
who else is he housed with?
Well, that would so then the obligation under Mr. Santiago's theory is that the warden of the prison, a 3,500 population prison, in the time it takes to process an emergency grievance, which is very quickly, would have to look up who Mr. Santiago's cellmate was and consider whether...
Do they not have computers over there?
Well, even if they did, Your Honor, it would still require the warden personally to do it.
Now, the warden could say to this subordinate, you know, look him up, what's his name?
And then I think in that situation, if the subordinate did it and ignored the results, or perhaps under a situation where he was required to do more, it would be the subordinate who would have liability.
Well,
under.
Then we'll have the ostrich instruction.
Did the grievance actually, was it phrased in terms of Santiago's fear of being attacked by his cellmate, or was it phrased in more general terms
it
about
was a general,
wanting a single cell?
It was a general request for a single cell status. He said that he was afraid that the people in the prison were housing him with people who were dangerous. It didn't even suggest that he knew that his cellmate was a particular danger to him, although it may have said that he had attacked prior people. But that is attached to my brief, Your Honor.
What grounds did your office provide for refusing Santiago's requests to depose certain of the defendants?
Your Honor, I don't know that I remember the grounds. I'm not sure he made a request. He may have.
Oh, yeah.
Was it a timely? I don't know if it was a timely request.
I think it was.
Okay. There was, it came up in the trial court because Mr. Santiago sought sanctions against our office, and the trial court eventually decided that that wasn't a proper posture because there was no indication that Mr. Santiago had tried to negotiate with our office over that question. No one was deposed in this case, by the way, Your Honor. Also, the trial court refused to allow us to depose Mr. Santiago because we had blown a time deadline. So...
Because you had...
We had not tried to depose Mr. Santiago before the discovery had closed. If I could turn briefly to what I can think of as the Pruitt problem, the second issue that Mr. Eikensier brings up. This is an odd case, an interesting case, because Mr. Santiago had counsel. He had counsel 3.5 months before trial. It's a very strange argument to argue that he was prejudiced by the lack of pretrial counsel at the discovery phase when his pretrial counsel who was preparing for trial could have very well made that argument to the trial court and resolved that problem at that stage and not here. It just seems to me that in this situation where someone has an attorney for that period of time, the court shouldn't presume that counsel was negligent in pursuing the discovery that was available. He could have pursued it, and I've given the court examples in my brief as well, where other attorneys who were appointed for, quote, purposes of trial only went back to the trial court and said to the court, please rescheduled discovery. We need to do something to get ready for our client for trial. Mr. Austin was available to Mr. Santiago. They should have discussed this. If there was evidence that should have been brought out at trial, Mr. Austin should have known about it. He should have asked the trial court to get it. The fact that he didn't should generate a presumption in the court that it was something that Mr. Austin decided wasn't worth pursuing, not a presumption that Mr. Austin didn't do his duty as an attorney. Section 1915E, although it allows the court to appoint an attorney, doesn't guarantee an indigent who gets that attorney that he'll have even minimal representation from that counsel. It's not a guarantee of quality when the court appoints an attorney. And I think any person who seeks counsel is at risk of having an attorney who doesn't do everything he should do, perhaps. To the extent that Mr. Austin didn't do it, it's not something that should result in a new trial. It's a question that should be addressed to Mr. Austin and Mr. Santiago. As I said, it was not on the eve of trial that Mr. Austin was appointed. It was 3.5 months. This court, Judge, you had asked Mr. Eikensteer whose duty it is to report a threat. I would argue that it is a prisoner's obligation, certainly, to report a threat that he knows about to prison authorities. And, in fact, Mr. Santiago was told in a grievance report, a result that was given to him in writing, that he was to report anyone he believed should be on his enemies list and that he would not be housed with that person. This court in Dale versus Poston, which is cited in my brief, made that point that it is incumbent upon prisoners to do something to protect themselves if they feel threatened. If a prisoner decides that he's better off not cooperating with authorities for his own protection and gets injured, that is just something that should not result in constitutional liability for the prison officials like Warden Walls in this case.
This was really a horrendous beating, wasn't it?
It's been alleged that it was a horrendous beating, Your Honor.
Blood everywhere.
Well, there was
the walls, the floors, the bed.
The beating from Castro is alleged to have been a very bloody beating, yes. This prisoner has alleged many, many things. And I know at the pleading stage we need to take those allegations as true, but I don't necessarily know that that is the case. Are there any other questions? Okay, then I would respectfully ask the court to affirm the judgment in all respects. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Eikensteer has how many minutes? Four? 4 minutes left.
Your Honor, there's three brief points in rebuttal. Hopefully I get through them all. The first is response to Mr. Elitz's assertion that that appointing pretrial or counsel for the purposes of trial somehow remedied the court's abuse of discretion earlier in failing to appoint counsel. Your Honor, one point of clarification is that Mr. Austin here, the appointed counsel, did not file appearance until less than 2 months before the trial. It's unclear. He was appointed explicitly for the purposes of trial. It's unclear if the court would have granted a motion to reopen discovery. But I think the larger point to grasp is that it simply can't be the rule that there can't be an abuse of discretion for failing to appoint pretrial counsel by appointing trial counsel, because it then puts the onus on the trial counsel to essentially relitigate, in this case, 5 years of pretrial discovery. And that's just an inefficient use of judicial resources. The Pruitt standard is not whether an inmate is competent to try his case. It's litigate. And litigate encompasses all of the pretrial preparation as well. And our point is simply not that every inmate coming out of the gate should get a lawyer. It's that when a case is dragged on for almost 3 years, it's the inmate has survived motions to dismiss, has a multi-count, multi-defendant claim, and is trying to obtain just fundamental discovery that perhaps then abuse of discretion happens when there's a failure to appoint counsel. The second point relates to count four, and we're certainly not alleging any kind of respondeat superior. This is not an inmate who was beat up and then says, somehow, for amorphous reasons, the entire prison hierarchy is liable. Mr. Santiago sends a grievance to the warden's office. The warden responds to that grievance a few days later with his signature. That it came out at trial, that it may have been a designee signature, is besides the point. I mean, self-serving testimony that was didn't have the benefit of depositions or cross-examination certainly can't defeat the allegation at the pleading stage that Walls knew about Castro's violent history. And the last point is simply, as to count one, the actual threat that inmate Harris yelled was, at least as Santiago characterized, was "Don't trip, I got you," not "Don't trip, I catch you." I don't know if that distinction is meaningful, but I think in the prison context, it's safe to say that that's not an invitation to tea. And it certainly has to be assumed that Santiago could prove that "I got you" means, you know, serious physical harm, if not worse. So I don't think that the words that were exchanged here between inmate and Castro somehow are fatal to that claim. Well, and if there are no further questions, Your Honor, I'll rest there.
Well, the case will be taken under advisement, of course. Mr. Eikenseer and Ms. Flath, you have the thanks of the court for taking on this appointment, as does the law firm of Skadden Arps, and for doing such a fine job for your client. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And, of course, as always, Mr. Ilitz, you have our thanks as well for the fine job the Attorney General's office does. But you get paid. All right. We will go on to case